Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. An opinion piece in yesterday's Charlotte Observer by UNC Chapel Hill Professor Jean Nichol quoted former Texas Congresswoman, the late Barbara Jordan, who Professor Nichols credited with giving one of the greatest speeches of the 20th century. The setting was the House Watergate Committee, and the Congresswoman set out to define impeachment, which she said arises from the misconduct of public men, the abuse or violation of the public trust. She said impeachment is an essential check against the encroachment of the executive. And she made another point that seems aimed at Capitol Hill today.
My faith in the Constitution is whole, it is complete, it is total. And I am not going to sit here and be an idle spectator to the diminution, the subversion, the destruction of the Constitution.
But the atmosphere in Congress today is much different than it was 45 years ago. Democratic Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi has been doing everything she can to keep the door closed on the impeachment of President Trump. And even as a growing number of Democrats see grounds for impeaching the president, Republicans are in lockstep with the chief executive. The fact that Democrats only control the House and not the Senate would mean that impeachment would be little more than a vote of condemnation, an exercise in futility that could easily backfire. But as the drumbeat gets louder, let's take a look at what impeachment is, how it works, and what it means. For that conversation, we're joined by one of the leading constitutional scholars in the nation, who has been an expert witness before Congress on all the major constitutional conflicts between presidents and Congress in the last 25 years, including the impeachment proceedings against President Clinton in 1997. Dr. Michael Gerhardt is a constitutional law professor at UNC Charlotte School of Law and the author of Impeachment, What Everyone Needs to Know. He joins us from the studios at UNC in Chapel Hill. Thank you for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. So let's begin by defining exactly what impeachment is and what it is not. How would you define it?
Sure. Impeachment generally has a technical meaning and a general meaning. The technical meaning is that it refers to the power of the House of Representatives to impeach or formally charge an impeachable official, which would include the president, for committing impeachable misconduct, certain kinds of misconduct laid out in the Constitution as treason, bribery, and other or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Impeachment also sometimes is used as a shorthand to refer to the whole process, which includes not just the House's impeaching someone, but then the Senate's subjecting that person to an impeachment trial and possibly convicting and removing them from office.
So is it a political process or is it a legal process or is it both?
I think it's best understood as a hybrid process. So it's both. It is certainly political in that it happens in Congress, and the usual subjects for impeachment are political figures. But it's also legal because it's constrained or bounded by the language of the Constitution, and there'll have to be some judgments made about whether or not the misconduct at issue fits within the constitutional meaning of an impeachable offense.
So talk of impeachment, particularly when it applies to the President of the United States, comes up periodically and has come up periodically in our history. But as I understand it, only two presidents have actually been impeached, Bill Clinton and Andrew Johnson. Neither was removed from office. Johnson was, I think, tried in the Senate, but they failed by one vote to convict him. Remind us, since you were involved in this, what was the case with President Clinton?
The case against President Clinton, of course, began with an investigation by a special counsel, Kenneth Starr, one of whose deputies was now Justice Brett Kavanaugh. And Starr's prosecutors found evidence of what they believe was impeachable misconduct by President Clinton, namely lying under oath about a sexual relationship he had with Monica Lewinsky, and then, according to them, trying to obstruct justice by hiding evidence about that relationship. The report was literally driven up to the Congress and unloaded so that the members of Congress in either the House or Senate could read the report. Republicans who were in the majority in the House found that report to be persuasive, that President Clinton had committed a series of impeachable offenses, and they proceeded to hold hearings and eventually voted to impeach President Clinton, and then the matter went to the Senate.
Where what happened? Nothing?
No. The Senate ended up not convicting. Mm-hmm. There were no more than 50 votes to convict and remove him, but the Constitution requires at least two-thirds vote in the Senate. So the Senate fell rather short of that constitutional threshold, and President Clinton, therefore, was not removed from office, and his popularity remained intact.
You are a constitutional law professor. You are listed as one of the foremost experts on that and on impeachment, because it's in the Constitution. And you were the only expert invited to speak behind closed doors to the entire House of Representatives during the Clinton impeachment. Can you share with us anything that happened behind those closed doors?
I don't think I can share very much, but it was an extraordinary honor to be invited behind closed doors to speak to the entire House of Representatives. So you can imagine it was like a gigantic classroom.
Did they ask questions, or did you just make a presentation?
I made a very short presentation, and then they asked a series of questions, and we had, a very constructive dialogue about impeachment.
But the House went ahead and impeached the president. So did your words fall on deaf ears, or did you advise them to do it?
No, actually neither. I did not see my role as pushing the House in one direction or another. I saw my role as trying to educate them about the law, so to speak, on the questions about impeachment. So I gave a historical background on the impeachment process. I tried to share with them historical material on the meaning of high crimes and misdemeanors. Mm-hmm. And I think they appreciated that this law professor did not come in and kind of speak down to them, but I was trying to help them. And so it wasn't moving them one way or another. And it's because of that, I think, that both Bobby Scott and Charles Kennedy, both of whom were on the House Judiciary Committee, one of whom is a Democrat, one of whom is a Republican, came up to me afterwards and said, would you be willing to testify if it comes to that?
Mm-hmm. Do you recall if the vote in the House split along party lines with President Clinton?
Almost exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
You were, I find this interesting because you were part of the Clinton Justice Department transition team, and you drafted his administration's judicial selection policy. That would seem, on the face of it, to make you a partisan. So why were you asked to be part of the impeachment proceedings against the president, or to testify and give a presentation before the House of Representatives?
Sure. Well, the work I did for President Clinton was during the transition. Mm-hmm. So this would have been back in 1992 to early 1993. The actual impeachment process was not kind of formally undertaken until around 1998. And in those intervening years, I was not a partisan. I was actually a dean of a law school and law professor. But most importantly, it was very clear, I think, from what I said and what I've written, that I was not a partisan when it comes to impeachment. I would like to think of myself as an expert, and I think people thought of me as that at that time. And this is one reason why before the House and later before the House Judiciary Committee, I didn't see my role as being an advocate. My role is there as an educator.
Now, President Nixon is the only president to have been forced from office. He resigned, but he resigned in the face of impending impeachment. He was convinced, if I recall correctly, by Republican Senator Barry Goldwater and others that it was inevitable and that he should not put the nation through such a spectacle. So he resigned. Other presidents, beginning with John Tyler, also faced impeachment, but it never happened. Obviously, impeachment is designed to be followed in the face of, quote, high crimes and misdemeanors. But how often is impeachment threatened for purely political reasons?
It's often used to threaten people, whether it's presidents or cabinet secretaries or others, judges, for example, just for political reasons. a number of people didn't like Earl Warren's writing the court's opinion in Brown versus Board of Education, so they put up billboards saying "Impeach Warren."
Mm-hmm.
It's not that unusual. In fact, it's probably rather common for presidents to be threatened with impeachment. It's much rarer for an actual impeachment proceeding to be undertaken. So with John Tyler, there were three different attempts. Each came closer to an impeachment, but all three failed.
When a president is impeached and the Senate chooses not to take up the case or does not convict, what in essence have we done? What in essence is impeachment? Is it a slap on the wrist? What is it?
I think it's more than that. To have the House of Representatives formally impeach a president is a seismic event in constitutional law. And so it's not just a slap on the wrist. It is something that stays with that president or judge or whomever else has been impeached for all time. It's part of the historical record. It's not something any president aspires to.
Hmm. The Constitution allows a president to be, quote, removed from office on impeachment and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. What exactly constitute high crimes and misdemeanors? That's pretty vague, it seems to me.
Well, it's vague, I think, to us, because it's language that dates all the way back to the British practice of impeachment. And the founders looked both at that British practice and the colonial practices where that language is used to refer to what the framers understood and the British understood as political crimes. Political crimes were not technically felonies or the things for which somebody could be sent to jail or even put to death. They were the kinds of crimes that political figures, as Representative Jordan was saying at the beginning, and she was quoting from Hamilton, these are the kinds of misconduct that can only be committed by people in high office. It's because of their position that these become crimes. They may or may not overlap with indictable crimes, but they are crimes, as she said, again quoting from Hamilton, that involved either serious abuses of power or breaches of the public trust.
So the I guess it should be pointed out that the Founding Fathers believed that not all crimes are impeachable and not all impeachable offenses are crimes. Can you explain that?
Sure. So to begin with, there are a lot of things that may be technically crimes. Destroying a mailbox, for example, jaywalking. But they don't rise to the level of misconduct that would be properly within the jurisdiction of impeachment. However, there are many things that could end up being properly understood as impeachable misconduct that don't violate any laws. For example, the abuse of the pardon power doesn't violate any laws. A president, and I'm just quoting or referring back to the Constitutional Convention, a president who's in concert with some criminal activity or in concert with foreign interests to undermine American interests, that's not a crime. It might not technically fit treason, but it's a political crime, and it's the appropriate thing to serve as a basis for impeachment.
Why wouldn't that be a crime?
Because there's no statute that makes it a crime.
But why isn't there one? That seems to be, on the face of it, a primary problem with officials who have access to foreign powers.
There may well be crimes that could apply.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, there may well be statutory crimes that could apply. But the critical thing the framers are trying to get at was the misconduct that wasn't set forth in the statute, but instead couldn't be gotten at.
Let's stop there. We have to take a break. We'll come right back with more. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Michael Gerhardt. He's a constitutional law professor at the UNC School of Law at Chapel Hill and the author of Impeachment, what everyone needs to know, a recognized scholar when it comes to the Constitution, one of the foremost scholars in the country when it comes to the Constitution. There's been a lot of discussion in the news and in personal conversations around the dinner tables or across the country in the situation involving President Trump and about whether the president obstructed justice with regard to the Russia investigation for Robert Mueller. And in doing so, did he break the law? There's been much discussion about whether he broke any laws that would qualify him for impeachment. And we've just said that impeachment doesn't have to be based on an actual criminal violation. So if impeachment isn't based on potential criminal violations, if it's not a crime that they're impeaching him on, does this not begin to slide down the slippery slope of just being politics? And if it's just politics, how do we justify it? He's a duly elected official.
This is a very good question. In one sense, it's all politics. So that is both too broad and too narrow. Everything that goes on in Congress is, to some extent, politics. The question becomes whether or not there is a political crime or political misconduct that rises to a certain level that would then be appropriate to consider as subject to impeachment. So the question then becomes whether or not the misconduct, we begin to focus on that and ask ourselves, does it satisfy the high criterion or criteria in the Constitution for impeachment? And that focus is really what matters. It will or may not draw bipartisan support. Oftentimes impeachment begins in a partisan atmosphere in the House. The question becomes whether or not in the Senate it can draw some bipartisan support, because the only way you get a conviction and removal is if you get at least that two-thirds threshold met.
So the House can impeach even though there is no crime.
Absolutely. That's true.
Can the Senate convict in the absence of a crime?
Absolutely. And it's done so. I'll give you one example, but there are many. There was a federal judge named Alcee Hastings. He was a federal district judge down in Florida. He was actually subjected to a criminal trial for perjury and obstruction. He was acquitted. After that, the Judicial Conference of the United States referred the matter to the House of Representatives. And the House of Representatives overwhelmingly voted to impeach him. The Senate voted overwhelmingly to remove him from office. So we can find in that situation that there's no the misconduct didn't meet necessarily the criteria for a criminal offense, which would include being shown beyond a reasonable doubt, but it did fit the criteria for a political crime, and that was enough to justify his removal.
So let's talk about the process, how this works. The Constitution says the House of Representatives shall have the sole power of impeachment. The House draws up articles of impeachment. In that sense, are they like a prosecutor and grand jury? Do they follow the same rules or laws that a grand jury would in bringing charges?
Well, one common perception of the House in that circumstance is it is similar to a grand jury. That was the argument of the House of Representatives when it was considering President Clinton's impeachment. The majority thought, okay, our responsibility is much like a grand jury. We've now indicted him, otherwise called an impeachment, and now the matter goes to the Senate for a trial. Others might think the House's role is more complex than that. It's not just a grand jury or prosecutor. It could also be an independent look at the seriousness of the misconduct and perhaps adopt the position that we're not just acting here as a grand jury, but we have found credible evidence of an impeachable offense. So what we have to kind of watch for whenever any particular misconduct is subject to congressional scrutiny and discussion about whether it's impeachable is what role does the House think it's performing? And then the same question will be asked later about the Senate.
Again, the Constitution says the Senate shall have the sole power to try all impeachment.
Right.
So once they vote yes in the House on articles of impeachment, when they say, okay, you've been impeached, is the Senate then compelled to hold a trial, or can they punt?
Well, that's a good question. So this came up in the Clinton impeachment, and it's come up in a number of prior impeachments, including one or two where the impeached official resigns from office before the trial begins.
Mm-hmm.
The Senate has generally taken the position that it is obliged to do something. It cannot ignore the fact the House has impeached that person. So the language which includes the word shall, means the Senate shall have to do something. That something is left to the discretion of the Senate. So, for example, Senator Trent Lott, who was the majority leader when Clinton's matter came to the Senate, decided we're not going to have a full-fledged trial like you might see on television or in the actual world, but we'll have an expedited proceeding. And so evidence was kind of put forward by both those seeking the ouster of President Clinton and those opposing it, and then the senators as a whole kind of deliberated on that and voted. So the Senate can craft almost any kind of procedure it thinks appropriate.
Remind us, I the technology has changed greatly since the Clinton administration in terms of how we get our news, but there was C-SPAN back then. Were either the impeachment hearings in the House or the Senate proceedings televised on C-SPAN? Would they be televised in the case of an impeachment of President Trump?
I think they would absolutely be televised. The impeachment of a judge might not be something that many people in America might want to follow. And so there have been many more impeachments of judges, for example, than presidents. But judicial impeachments tend to happen, and we described as below radar. But if you impeach a president, that is big news. That is of monumental interest to the American people. It was televised with Nixon. It was televised with Clinton. I'm sure it would be televised for any other president.
So in the trial of impeachment involving a president of the United States, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court presides, and two-thirds majority of the Senate has to vote in favor if they're going to convict. In the case of Richard Nixon, he faced a democratically controlled Congress, but it was a Republican, Barry Goldwater, that went to the president and told him he would not survive impeachment. Would the reverse be true today, do you think? I mean, would a Republican senator go to President Trump and say, you need to resign because you're going to be convicted? Or would they just let the process take place?
Well, it's a good question. I can't put myself into their heads. It seems, as you said at the outset of the show, that the Republicans right now are in lockstep with the president. So one would have to imagine what kind of misconduct would be so awful and so serious that it would lead a Republican senator to do that. It's just hard to imagine what that might be.
If an impeachment trial would be held in the Senate, who would be the how does it work? Who's the prosecutor? How is the defense handled? Is it handled that way, or is it a completely different process than a trial?
It's a unique process. So it might have some parallels to an actual trial, but it doesn't necessarily have to follow those. So the prosecutors, so to speak, are appointed in the House after there's been an impeachment. And those prosecutors turn out to be members of the Judiciary Committee, typically, who favored impeachment and who argued for it in the House. They come to the Senate as what is called House managers. The House managers will put forward the case for conviction and removal. Then the president typically has the opportunity to hire, his own lawyers. Andrew Johnson hired some of the best in the country, including Benjamin Curtis, a former Supreme Court justice, to represent him. Nixon had some terrific lawyers as well, and Clinton, of course, had some also. So the president's entitled to a defense, and he'll also be entitled to choose the people who will speak for him.
So people come forward to testify for and against just as they would in a court of law, or is this something different?
I think it'll turn out to be something different in the Senate. I think the Senate is less likely to be concerned or at least have any kind of formal hearing on has there been impeachable misconduct. Instead, what's going to happen is that the senators themselves will have to consider the evidence. So the focus of the trial typically is on the evidence, and then the lawyers on each side, or the managers on one side, lawyers on the other, they will argue about whether or not something bad did happen, and also whether or not that something bad rises to the level of impeachable offense.
So the jury is the Senate.
Yes.
Are they sworn in as jurors, or do they simply take that role because of their position as United States senators? And I ask the question because we are living now in a highly partisan environment. It's much more partisan than it was even during the Nixon administration. Could a senator be given the benefit of the doubt that without being sworn in as a juror to convict on the evidence, that they would in fact convict on the evidence?
The Constitution requires senators in a presidential impeachment trial to be on oath or affirmation. So they all would have to take an oath. Then presumably the senators are obviously fulfilling their oath in doing whatever they choose to do.
Constitution says that judgment in cases of impeachment extend only to a person's removal from office. So does that mean if the Senate would find a person guilty of crimes, that they could not punish that person for those crimes beyond removal from office? Is that what that means?
Yes. So the Senate's only powers of punishment, so to speak, are removal from office, and then the other is disqualification from office. So removal is obviously somebody is just immediately ousted from office. Disqualification has to do with barring the person from ever serving again in a federal office, and also withholding any pensions or other benefits they have because of prior service in federal office.
So if a trial unfolded in the Senate, let's remove President Trump from this equation. If a president, any president, was tried in the Senate for high crimes and misdemeanors or whatever offenses the House found to be impeachable, and they turned out to be great evidence of actual crimes, they can only remove him from office, him or her. So would that open the door then to a court prosecuting that individual for the crimes that they uncovered in this trial in the Senate?
Yes. So the Constitution also makes clear that impeachment doesn't preclude a criminal proceeding. The question that gets debated all the time is a very difficult question, is whether or not that any criminal proceeding could begin before the president leaves office. But it's a simple, easy case, at least in the abstract. If the Senate removes a president, then that president becomes a private citizen and is subject to any kind of legal liability that could be brought.
So who would take the lead on that, the Justice Department or some other entity?
Could be the Justice Department. It might end up being a special prosecutor appointed by the Justice Department. It could be a U.S. attorney, which is part of the Justice Department. It's not any criminal proceeding would have to be brought by the government, and particularly the federal government. And I guess the state government, too, could bring proceedings if there's a state crime involved as well, and a private citizen is not protected from state prosecution for a serious crime.
So in the case of President Trump, the Robert Mueller report, many have interpreted it as essentially laying the groundwork for an impeachment trial, or at least laying at the feet of the Congress. Here's my evidence. I can't convict because of a Justice Department memo, but you can take this and use it as a blueprint. Many people have interpreted it in that way. If that is the case, and if the Congress decides to impeach and the Senate were to convict, would the Mueller report then become evidence of crimes that would be used in a trial? Or would they have to relaunch a new investigation if they wanted to?
Well, it could be one, it could be the other, or it could be both. The Mueller report does lay certain things out and could be taken as having provided enough evidence to justify an impeachment. Recall that the Starr referral was the only evidence the House relied on in order to impeach President Clinton. But the House could do more investigation, and the Senate typically would want to do some of its own fact-finding and not just probably rely on the referral. The question just becomes whether or not the Senate's going to be able to do that. With Bill Clinton's case, Majority Leader Lott decided, enough's enough. We've got this referral. We don't think there's going to be any new evidence, although they did cross-examine some figures in that referral. But they did very little fact-finding, and ultimately their decision was based on the referral.
Michael Gerhardt is our guest. He's a constitutional law professor at the UNC School of Law in Chapel Hill and the author of Impeachment, What Everyone Needs to Know. I mentioned that he testified before Congress, before the entire House of Representatives behind closed doors during the Clinton impeachment. You also testified before the House Judiciary Committee on July 12th of this year on constitutional processes for addressing presidential misconduct. in which you reminded members that, quote, congressional oversight is a longstanding means for either chamber or both to investigate possible presidential wrongdoing. Why did they ask you to testify?
I can guess at this. So you might have to talk to them. But I think particularly the chairman felt that I was somebody who had long studied this process and had a credible sort of expertise on the subject. One of the things that I have done, for example, way back with Clinton, is I had written all about impeachment well before Clinton was subject to it. So there was no sense, nobody had the idea that, oh, he's just writing about it to address Clinton. Mm-hmm. I'd done it years before. And I've been writing about it over the last 30 years. And nobody can predict when or if it ever happens again. So I think the chairman understood that writing that I've done, studying I've done, research I've done, is relevant precisely because I haven't been driven by a partisan agenda, but by a scholarly one, trying to get to a deep understanding of the process.
You reminded the House Judiciary Committee in that testimony that there is nothing in the Constitution governing the procedures either House would have to take in conducting its business, including impeachments. And you said that there's nothing in the Constitution dictating the procedure each chamber must use to issue subpoenas and to initiate or conduct investigations. Why do they have to be reminded of that?
It's a good question. I think they had to be reminded of that because they're particularly Republican members of the Judiciary Committee and elsewhere in the House were arguing that certain procedures had to be followed before a subpoena could be directed at the President of the United States. In the present circumstances, under the present statutory framework set out by Congress, the chairman of the committee has the authority on his own, by himself, on his independently, to be able to issue a subpoena. And some Republicans were arguing, no, it ought to be done either by the committee or by the House as a whole. And my testimony, therefore, was a little bit of a response to that, saying, no, it doesn't have to follow any particular kind of procedure. But if Congress has laid out in the statute that a chairman of a committee has subpoena power, then that's lawful.
Yeah, so in other words, they can make up their own rules as they go along. There's nothing in the Constitution mandating exactly what they have to do and when they have to do it. That's accurate, right? Yes or no, because I'm out of time.
Yeah.
Okay. Dr. Michael Gerhardt's with us. We'll come back with more about impeachment and the process in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Dr. Michael Gerhardt, constitutional law professor at UNC School of Law in Chapel Hill, the author of Impeachment, What Everyone Needs to Know, and a recognized constitutional scholar when it comes to impeachment. Is there anything in the Constitution that mandates that those subpoenaed by Congress must comply with that subpoena? Is there anything in the Constitution that lays out penalties for defying congressional subpoenas?
Well, of course, the word subpoena does not appear in the Constitution, but a subpoena is by definition a lawful order. So the Constitution does lay out some mechanisms for dealing with illegal misconduct. It doesn't necessarily have to be an impeachment. It could be a prosecution. But if any official breaks the law, there's not certainly any official, let's say, below the President of the United States, breaks the law, that person is subject to criminal prosecution, among other things.
But so in other words, if you defy a congressional subpoena, you are in contempt of Congress, and therefore you are in contempt of the Constitution, and therefore you have broken the law?
Well, you've broken the law because, again, the subpoena, by definition, is a legal order, mm-hmm. a lawful order. And under the Constitution, there are various mechanisms made available, some expressly, some by inference, that allow for the enforcement of the law against somebody who's broken the law. So that's the circumstance we're in when somebody defies a subpoena.
So I want to come back to that in just a moment, but we're going to take a break in our conversation, and I want to bring on Congresswoman Alma Adams from North Carolina's 12th Congressional District. She's a Democrat, of course. Congresswoman Adams, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Mike. Good to be with you.
You came out in support of an impeachment inquiry in May. Was that in response to anything in particular, or had you just reached the point where you felt it was obvious an inquiry was needed?
Well, first of all, I really did get to the point where I felt it was needed. But the thing that really, as you say, broke the straw that broke the camel's back for me was getting Mueller's a statement back in terms of the things that he found that we were able to see. And the fact that he did suggest, but he said that they didn't find, that they didn't really clear him of that. But I think there were a number of things that were very questionable in my mind. And I was at the point where I felt we did need to move forward with an inquiry.
Did Mr. Mueller's testimony before Congress, either both of those committees, amplify or strengthen your belief in his original report and what you think it said, or did it change your mind in any way?
Well, it did reinforce it. I mean, the fact to hear the voice of the person who prepared the report, who did the research, and who did basically the investigation. It was really helpful for me. But I think just when the final report came in and the things that he outlined there, that and the fact that he said that because of what the Department of Justice's rule overall was, practice that they had of not charging a sitting president, seemed to me put him in a different position. And I just think even though everybody needs to be accountable as an elected official, I'm accountable to people. The president as well should be accountable for his actions as well.
So you, in your view, the president has done what?
Well, I think that there is suggestion that that there may be there were some things that he shouldn't have done. I mean, in terms of interactions with or at least his team with first of all, the president does not tell the truth. So I think the inquiries that are going on right now in Congress I think are important because. Hopefully, the Judiciary Committee, the Oversight and Reform Committee, the Financial Services Committee, Ways and Means and Foreign Affairs that are all doing separate investigations looking at different things, what's really in his tax forms, what kind of comments. There's a suggestion that there were some things that were inappropriate, I think, for a president to do, and that there might be a cause in terms of corruption. So, I think we still have some more information that we need, and then we need to move forward.
As we've been talking with Michael Gerhardt, you don't have to have evidence of crimes to impeach. They can be misconduct of other processes that do not reach the level of a crime. And the drumbeat is growing louder. Nancy Pelosi has kept the lid on this for a very long time, but the number of congressional Democrats who are now calling for impeachment is growing. But then there are others, like North Carolina Representative David Price, who said last week, there's nothing that's going on right now that an impeachment inquiry would add to. Why are some of them not on board with your position, which you took in May?
Well, I think, I respect everybody for their position. I certainly have a lot of respect and admiration for Congressman Price. He's been a great mentor. Certainly he's been at this longer than this aspect in terms of Congress, longer than I. And people have to, I think, get to that place on their own. And so, I think that again, as it continues to grow, I think we'll probably see more folks doing something.
Do you worry that if an impeachment eventually takes place in the House, that it would all be for naught, given the Republican majority in the Senate? And if you impeach and they do not convict or choose not to even have a they just don't see it your way, does that play into their hands for the election? Do you worry about that?
Well, you know, I think we have to worry about this president regardless. He's a problem. He's an embarrassment.
There are some who would argue that the House of Representatives and some people in the Senate are an embarrassment. Is that a reason to impeach?
That's fine, but they're not. But there's no question about whether or not we should impeach him. Members of the Senate, members of the House. So that's not the question before us. So, but I do think it could. I don't think right now with the Senate, with the positions that they've taken and the things that they have done and not done, like. He's got 120 pieces of legislation that they have not, sitting on their doorstep, and they've about to take that up. The fact that they've all been very silent about the misconduct of this president, including the hate that he tends to spew when he gets out into the community. I mean, so they're not talking about anything. They just think, you know, they're saying, well, the economy's good, so we can just turn our heads to the other things that he's doing, to the comments that he's making, to the hate and all those things. So we don't care about that. We want to win this election by any means necessary, so we're going to let him do what he wants to do. But I can tell you, if this were any other president, this had been the most recent president that we had before this one, they'd be talking, and they'd be talking very loudly. So, we'll just have to see.
One of the reasons that nobody's talking is because President Trump has made the Republican Party his party, and there's lots of fear about going against him because there are elections coming up, and nobody wants to be primaried, and nobody wants to lose. So, but behind the scenes, you're in Congress. Do you talk to Republicans in the House or in the Senate? Are you hearing them express discomfort or dissatisfaction or distrust of the president that maybe if he was in a weakened state brought on by impeachment, they would feel less afraid of going against him?
Well, I think so. And I think that's why we need to, this inquiry and possibly move forward past that. I think they are afraid. And I just think you shouldn't be. You shouldn't have that kind of fear. When you see all that's going wrong, when you have some sense of your own principles and morals, that you are still able to just sit silently by and not say anything. So I'm really disappointed in the Senate for that reason. You know, nobody's going to frighten me to the degree that I'm going to do what I know is not proper to do. I just don't have a lot of respect for folks who do that. And to let one person, the president, and then Mitch McConnell, that we have constituents, we all do. And I can tell you, yes, I've heard Republicans talk about the fact that they are very concerned, but yet they're silent. And, you know, when I think about Martin Luther King, when he said that people will remember, or they may not remember the words of their enemies, but they will remember the silence of their friends. Now, if they're our friends, if they're friends of the people, to be silent, to see all that's going on in this country, to hear this president and the many awful racist kinds of things that he says, and then you don't say anything because you're afraid. Because you might lose the election. Maybe you should lose the election, you know. But anyway, we'll have to see.
Nancy Pelosi has found many ways to make this not happen. She thinks that for many reasons, from one of which is the fact she thinks it's politically, it could be politically detrimental to Democrats to pursue this course of action. But in the face of the Mueller report and the Mueller testimony, that has caused a number of people in the caucus, the Democratic caucus, to increase the numbers who favor impeachment. Is there a breaking point at which you see Nancy Pelosi opening the door to impeachment?
Well, let me just first say that I have a tremendous amount of respect and admiration for our speaker. Not only has she been a friend, she's been a great leader. And I respect the position that she's taken. I mean, you know, but I think everybody has some breaking point. And I don't know that for sure in terms of what she may or may not do. But we're going to have to be together either way as a party to move forward anyway. So I have to appreciate everyone for having their opinion. I have mine. Yesterday I had two town halls here in Mecklenburg County. That is the second to all of the violence and the killings and so forth. Impeachment came right behind it, as something that people wanted to talk about and so forth and so on. But, you know, I imagine it could go either way, but I certainly believe that if we are at a point where we're going to release a president who has committed wrongdoings, and we're going to, you know, nobody is above the law. Let me just say it that way, and not even President Trump. So, you know, we'll as a Congress, I think we ultimately will do what we know we need to do. At least that's my hope.
North Carolina 12th District Congresswoman Alma Adams, thank you for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mike. You have a good day.
You too. Michael Gerhardt has been with us for the whole hour. He's back with us again, constitutional law professor at UNC School of Law in Chapel Hill. Impeachment, What Everyone Needs to Know is the name of his book. Let's talk about something that the congresswoman just said. She said the president lies a lot. Well, he does. The Washington Post has documented the lies. They're in the thousands now. Do I understand you to believe that a president lying to the public could be considered an impeachable offense?
Under the right circumstances, I think the answer is yes. Imagine, for example, a president lies about the reasons for going to war. Abraham Lincoln, when he was in the House of Representatives, kept insisting that James Polk had broken the law in initiating war against Mexico. And so he tried to get him censured in the House. And a president, let's say a president lies about a treaty or lies about something else. Or they're just 1,000 cuts, so to speak, that any one of which might not be impeachable, but together erode the credibility of the office. Any of those things could provide a basis for impeachment.
Engaging in activity that would be considered injurious to the republic would be an impeachable offense, you're saying?
That is correct.
Okay. There's politics, and then there is justice, and some Democrats are frustrated in this situation because they feel not to impeach the president on the evidence that they have at hand is a miscarriage of justice, even if they know he won't be convicted in the Senate. They believe the situation and the acts alleged by the Mueller report and by others require the House to impeach. Are they right?
It's hard for me to talk about justice. Something, of course, the members of Congress have to come to terms with. But what I can say is that if the House fails to impeach, a legitimate question for everybody to ask is, what kind of precedent does that set for the future, for any other president, not just this president, but for any other president? And when the House either impeaches or doesn't, those actions become historical precedents, which become relevant later.
I have 1,000 more questions about process and impeachment and that memo that the Justice Department has that says you can't indict a sitting president, which is also not in the Constitution. It's just a memo, but we don't have time to get an answer. Michael Gerhardt is a constitutional law professor at the UNC School of Law in Chapel Hill and the author of Impeachment, What Everyone Needs to Know. Thank you for joining us for the hour. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.